On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. We begin today with our Focus on the County series. This morning, a conversation with first-term Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Shue. He was one of three county executives elected in the Baltimore region in the Republican wave led by Governor Larry Hogan. When Steve Shue took office in late 2014, he was the third person to head the county in 2 years, following the scandal-ridden administration of John Leopold and the brief tenure of Laura Newman. His working relationship with the county council has not always been smooth. We'll talk about his plans to streamline government, reduce taxes, and build more schools. Steve Shue on what's ahead for Anne Arundel County. Then, Baltimore author James Magruder on his latest novel, a tale about the love lives of graduate students in the 1980s. Plus, Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. And so today, we're going to continue our Focus on the County series with a conversation with Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Shue. Anne Arundel County includes the state capitol, the Naval Academy, about 500 miles of shoreline on the Chesapeake, the NSA, and Fort Meade. Steve Shue is a Republican who was elected in 2014, one of three county executives in the Baltimore region, along with Alan Kittleman in Howard County and Barry Glassman in Harford County, who were elected in a wave that sent many new Republicans to office, along with Governor Larry Hogan. Mr. Shue won his 2014 general election race after a hotly contested Republican primary race against then-acting county executive Laura Newman. He's 55 years old. He grew up in Crofton, currently lives on Gibson Island. He's the father of two college-aged children, and he's engaged to be married. He was in business for more than 30 years before he was elected county executive, including running a private equity firm, and he also served two terms in the Maryland legislature, representing Pasadena, Glen Burnie, and Brooklyn Park. Steve Shue, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So it's been a common campaign theme for some time now of folks who are in business who decide to go into the public sector, that their business experience is going to pertain directly and be a really good asset when it comes to running county government. You were in business, as I mentioned, for a long time. You still have some business interests, I guess. And I wonder, now you've been in the job as county executive, you know, a year and a half or so. What's your view in office, and has that changed at all from your view on the campaign trail? It's one thing to say that business skills and business experience are applicable to running a county government or any government entity. And it's another thing to actually do it. What's your take so far into your first term here?
Well, you often hear elected officials say, we're going to run this government like a business. And the fact of the matter is, you can't. And most of the people I hear say that have probably never been in business themselves, because many...
Or maybe never in government themselves.
Well, it could be. But there are business principles that are applicable to government, but government can never be run like a business, because at the end of the day, government is spending other people's money, not its own. And it does not have to live to the discipline of the bottom line and to earn a return on capital or to make a profit. It is fundamentally a service enterprise. But there are, as I said, applicable business principles, managerial principles, organizational principles, accountability, and we're working very hard to bring those applicable business principles to Anne Arundel County government.
You had a you applied for the job when John Leopold left office in disgrace. He had been convicted of a crime, and he left office. You applied to the city council, you and many other people. The council chose a different option. They chose Laura Newman. You then ran against Ms. Newman in a primary, which you won. It was a tough election. Things got pretty hot throughout that election. And then you won, of course, the general election. I wonder, that experience of, you know, applying to the county council and then having a tough primary and then becoming elected, where did that leave your relationship with the county council as you started a year and a half ago? Where does that relationship stand now?
We have an excellent relationship today with the county council. The beginning was a little rocky, I must say, and I don't think it was because of the contested primary or the unfortunate history of our county leadership over recent years. It was more the changes in policies that we implemented in our first year. Very substantial changes in tax policy. We implemented the largest tax cut in county history. We implemented very dramatic changes in our infrastructure construction efforts. Significantly accelerating school construction and redirected our school construction toward the development of smaller neighborhood schools. Anne Arundel County has the largest average size high schools in the state. And our children are suffering and our educators are suffering as a consequence of those very large mega structures.
So was it that those issues were just politically contentious had everything been had none of that history with the primary and the previous year or so before you were elected, had that not happened, you don't think it would have mattered? I mean, in other words, did you just have sort of basic philosophical political disagreements with members of the council?
I came in with a very definite agenda. One of the really good things about contested primaries in our country is they help candidates refine their message, develop their plans, and upon election, they arrive after a healthy primary with very definite ideas of where they want to go. And I knew exactly what I wanted to do with respect to tax policy, educational policy, reforming county government, cleaning up our waterways, and improving public safety. And those initiatives were new to our county council in many ways and were going in directions that were different from what they had been accustomed to. Plus, I was the new kid on the block, so it takes some getting used to when a new executive arrives on the scene, as I did. And we had been through a lot of turmoil. And in times of leadership turmoil, the legislative branch of government often assumes many of the responsibilities of the executive branch of government. When the executive branch of government is on its back and in disarray, the legislature, by its nature, will step in and sort of run the show. And I think that's what has been going on in Anne Arundel County for a long time. Not so much today. We have a very strong executive branch, again, with very definite policy directions, very strong staff, and we're working very hard to implement that plan. And it's put, I would say, the legislative branch back into its more normal and customary role of board of directors and overall decision maker regarding policy. Again, we propose policy, we advocate policy, but it is their job to make final determinations of policy, and then the executive branch executes the law as directed by the council.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Shue. There has just this week been talk of a charter amendment to extend the terms of the current city council from 2 terms to 3. That would mean the maximum time a person could serve would be 12 years rather than 8. There are 4 Democrats and 3 Republicans on a 7-member council in Anne Arundel County. Where do you stand on that proposal, and what do you think the chances of this charter amendment making it to the voters in November?
We oppose that initiative. And I must say, I think the councilman advocating for that change of term limits have a tin ear and aren't listening to the voters. I think if we learn anything from the current political season, it's that the voters are not interested in elected officials turning these positions into long-term career opportunities for themselves.
So you think that if it does make it to the ballot, that it will, your guess would be that it wouldn't pass?
I think it will fail at the ballot, and I think it will cause lasting damage to any councilman that votes for it.
Let's talk about the budget for 2017, which you've proposed, and it seems that it's going considerably more smoothly than the first budget that you proposed for fiscal 2016. What's the difference between the relationship with the council and the way the budget process is playing out this year from last year?
There are probably 2 major differences between this year and last year. Last year was rocky. This year was very smooth. Last year, the budget process was essentially thrust upon us the very moment we came into office, and there was very little time for preparation or for working hand in hand with the council to develop the budget. So it was dropped in their laps without a lot of good preparation. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of major policy changes are reflected in that budget. Budgets are reflections of policy direction at the end of the day. And a lot was asked of that council last year. This year, we're all used to working together. I think our team did a much better job of working with the council early on to make sure they were comfortable with the direction the budget was going. And the policy directions have largely been set. So this year's budget was much more a continuation of the directions that were established last year.
Let's talk about your priorities. We've got a couple of minutes before we take a little break for the news, and we'll come back and talk some more. But certainly school funding, a big priority. You talked about the size of many of the schools in Anne Arundel County. You've got one elementary school, Tyler Heights, I guess, which has like something like 14 portable units on its campus. Obviously, school funding, a big priority in this year's budget.
Huge priority. We have 5.5 major priorities. One is reducing taxes and fees to make it easier for people to live and work in our county. The second is to accelerate school construction. We have fallen way behind in school construction, and that's why we have these situations like Tyler Heights and these enormous high schools, because we haven't built a new high school, incrementally new high school, since 1982. And so we are now pursuing the most aggressive school construction program in Anne Arundel County history. We also face, like many Maryland jurisdictions, immense challenges from heroin and gangs and other criminal activity. We are increasing the size of our public safety departments, police, fire, sheriff's department, and fighting back against these drug dealers. And we are reforming county government. That's our fourth priority. Trying to streamline processes, bring those business principles into county government, trying to cut our permitting time in half and save taxpayer dollars on such governmental functions as procurement, the purchasing of services, and finally, cleaning up our waterways. Anne Arundel County, you mentioned in the introduction, has over 500 miles of waterways. That's more than any other Maryland jurisdiction. We're the water people, but some of our waterways are impaired, and we have to take responsibility for cleaning them up and assuring a good quality of life for our citizens.
All right, so we'll talk about some of those individually and how you're approaching those problems when we come back for a break. So if I can impose on you to stick around, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Hsu. It's Maryland Morning. This is the latest edition of our Focus on the Counties series. We'll have more with County Executive Hsu after a break for the news. So stick around. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's Maryland Morning. Here's Mr. Sternum.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
And welcome back. It is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. This is the third installment of our Maryland Morning Focus on the County series. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with other county executives around the region. If you're just joining us this morning, Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Hsu is with me here in Studio A. So, Mr. Hsu, you talk about your 5.5-point plan for the county. We got through 5 points. There's a half point, too, that you've added. It doesn't, I guess, quite rise to the level of a platform plank, but it is something that you've got on the radar screen. And how are you describing that one?
It's a half point, but it's an important point, and it is quality of life. Anne Arundel County has never really focused on assuring a really high quality of life for our citizens, and have not invested in the infrastructure to achieve that over the years. We are working to expand our network of regional parks, to expand our network of bike trails. We have lots of beautiful trails, but they're short segments and disconnected. We're trying to connect them all so that people can travel from the north to the south, to the east and the west, out to our beautiful waterfront parks safely and easily. We are expanding our network of boat ramps. Interestingly, until a few weeks ago, Anne Arundel County did not operate a single county-owned boat ramp. And unless you live in a water-privileged community or belong to a marina or a yacht club, it's very hard to access the water. Only 2% of our shoreline is in public hands. So we are opening boat ramps on the north and south shore of every major river in our county. And we're also opening our beaches for swimming for the first time in decades in our county, and people love it. They're coming out to our beaches with umbrellas and radios and their kids and having picnics and just having a great old time. So my hope is that a few years from now, we will have an unsurpassed quality of life in Anne Arundel County.
Why is it, for example, with 500 miles or so of shoreline in Anne Arundel County, that there have not been public boat ramps in all this time? Obviously, it sounds like there's local opposition. Maybe generally people think that's a great idea, but specifically they don't want it anywhere near their house.
That's part of it. There have been some sporadic attempts over the decades to open certain areas for swimming or to develop parks. And yes, you do always trigger local opposition in the immediate area of those proposed facilities because people are concerned, and rightly so, about traffic and parking and other nuisances and impact to the environment. So whenever we pursue any of these projects, we make sure that we are addressing any traffic, parking, or environmental issues that could affect neighborhoods or the property itself.
You talk about in your five-point plan, one thing is to reduce taxes. In your fiscal 17 budget, you estimate about an $11 million income tax cut for county residents. What's the trade-off there? What's going to happen because of those cuts?
Well, fortunately, there is no trade-off because our economy is growing vigorously. In the absence of that tax cut, would have seen revenues increase because of economic activity, growing incomes by about $60 million for our county government. So our tax cut reduces that to about $50 million. So we still have $50 million to make important investments in public safety, in our quality of life infrastructure and technology in other areas without having to cut services.
And on the county level, do you have evidence yet that tax cuts are going to spur job growth, for example?
That's our goal, is to spur job creation and economic activity.
Is there any evidence so far that that's happening?
Well, our unemployment is very, very low. Corporate profits are growing. Incomes are growing in our county at a very high rate of speed. Can I attribute that to the income tax cut? I wouldn't go that far. It's part of a much longer term plan to gradually moderate the level of taxation in our county. We're also cutting fees. We implemented this year the largest fee cut in county history, a $75 million cut in the fees that businesses and individual families pay to hook up to our water and sewer system. That will pump $75 million back into the economy and create jobs.
Let's talk about the schools again in terms of the school board. We talked about school construction and the importance of that and the fact that you've got that in your current budget. Anne Arundel County is one of the only counties in Maryland where the school board is appointed entirely by the governor. Do you think the school board in Anne Arundel County should be elected?
It should be elected, and as a state delegate, I introduced legislation on multiple occasions to convert our school board to an elected school board. We have very dedicated school board members. I have no issue with them as people or in their conduct. They're good people, but their manner of appointment is extremely problematic. We are not only one of the only appointed school boards in the state, we're one of the only appointed school boards in the country. Almost all school boards in the United States are elected. It is pure politics that Anne Arundel County School Board is appointed.
And what's the chance of that happening?
A lot better. It suited some of the powers that be when it was a certainty that there would be a Democratic governor and a strong likelihood of a Democratic county executive at the helm in the county itself. So it worked well to have a fully appointed board. And for most of the history of the Anne Arundel County School Board, it was not a diverse board from a political perspective. It was usually eight Democrats and one Republican. I don't think that's fair to the citizens of our county because our county is a 50-50 county. We're about equally split between the two parties and with a very large number of independents. And I think Governor Hogan's goal and my goal is to make sure that that school board looks like our county. And then that applies to all of our commission and board appointments throughout county government. I'm very proud of the diversity that we have injected into our boards and commissions through the appointment process. If you look in the aggregate at all of my over 200 appointments, it's about equally split between Democrats and Republicans and with a large number of independents. We're also diverse with respect to gender and with respect to race. Our African-American appointments equal 16% of all appointments, which is exactly equal to the African-American composition of our county. Same for minorities as a whole. We're about 23% minority. So are our appointments.
Speaking of African-Americans, there's a caucus of African-American leaders that you meet with pretty regularly. How would you gauge the racial climate in Anne Arundel County? This is a couple of weeks where we've seen racially charged incidents involving the police and people in, you know, St. Paul, Minnesota, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the president and former President Bush speaking very eloquently yesterday at the memorial service for the five police officers killed in Dallas. This is clearly a problem that permeates all of American society. It's a problem that the city of Baltimore is wrestling with. What's the relationship, for example, between law enforcement and members of communities of color in Anne Arundel County?
The relationship between our minority communities and our public safety departments is excellent. Those relationships are very, very strong. Anne Arundel County is a very different place from some of the other jurisdictions you see around the country where there is so much tension and distrust between those local communities and law enforcement. We don't have that in Anne Arundel County.
Really? You think that that's just not an issue in Anne Arundel County? How can it be an issue almost everywhere else?
It's an area on which we focus, and we make sure that there is a constant dialogue ongoing between our government, including law enforcement and our minority communities. That's why I meet regularly with the Caucus of African-American Leaders, as do the leaders of our public safety organizations. In Anne Arundel County, we respect our police. We value them and appreciate what they do every day. And that goes for our minority communities, too. I think we're always on the lookout for instances of excessive use of force, which is of great concern to the minority community. And I believe the leadership of our minority communities feels that we are just as concerned about it and just as focused on it as they are.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Hsu. Talking about public safety, you mentioned the epidemic of opioid abuse and the drug problem, which you're wrestling with in Anne Arundel County, again, as so many jurisdictions around the country are wrestling with it. What's your, in terms of opioid abuse in particular, this is an issue that Governor Hogan brought up during the campaign. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, is a national advocate for approaches and strategies to address this problem. What is the problem in Anne Arundel County, and how are you addressing it?
It's an epidemic, and it's a disaster. A year ago, when I came into office, a little over a year ago, the first thing I did was declare a public health emergency regarding heroin. And the reason I did is because we were experiencing an overdose a day and a fatality a week. At that time, we established a task force to study the matter and to develop proposals. 35 proposals were put forward. We have implemented them. Every major department of county government is involved. We are energized and focusing on this issue, but I am sad and heartbroken to report that a year down the line, that overdoses are now running at a rate of double that of a year ago, and we are now experiencing two fatalities a week. There will be well over 100 fatalities from heroin and other opiates this year in Anne Arundel County. It is a disaster.
And the task force is saying that you should be doing what?
We're approaching the matter from three respects. First is law enforcement. We're going after these dealers like they've never been gone after before by increasing the number of personnel we have in our dedicated narcotics units, by employing different policing strategies. Our sheriff's deputies are prioritizing heroin-related warrants when they serve warrants and get those people off the streets. But law enforcement alone will never solve this problem, and that's why we're secondly focusing on human services, making sure people have the opportunities to rehabilitate, to confront their addictions and become well and functioning people in our society. Our goal is not to put addicts into jail. We want to put the dealers in jail and get the addicts into treatment. But the most important piece number three, is education. The long-term solution to this crisis is educating our young people about the dangers of these drugs and assuring that they never get involved with them in the first place.
Could you weight those three to me? Because there's almost no one that I've talked to who says that law enforcement even begins to really address the problem of opioid addiction. That's something that so many studies have shown, you know, just is really a very small piece of it. I mean, but it's interesting to me that you mentioned that first. I mean, of those three things, is it 30%, 30%, 40%? What is it?
I don't think about it in those terms exactly. I think they're all important. We have to go after the dealers because they are peddling poison to our children, and we have to go after them aggressively. But we also have to help people. People, once addicted, once they're captured by these drugs, it takes an immense effort on their part and on society's part to help them recover and return to society as fully functional individuals to achieve their potentials. But in the long run, I guess if I had to say what's most important, it's education. It's educating people about the dangers and recognizing the signs of addiction. That's why we are conducting town halls all over our county. We're bringing in national speakers to address student groups, parent groups. We are doing a public service announcement. So I'm filming a public service announcement later today to air on our own county television program. So we're doing everything we can think of to educate our citizens about the dangers of these drugs. That probably over the long run is most important because that is the solution. Like you said, you can't police your way out of this. And sadly, once a person is addicted, you're fighting a rear guard action. You can get them into treatment, into recovery, but you've lost. Now you're just trying to figure out the terms of surrender. It's education that's going to be how we win this war.
You're headed to Cleveland on Monday to attend the Republican National Convention. You're a delegate. Who are you supporting for president?
Well, all Maryland delegates are bound in the first and possibly the second round of voting, depending upon how the second round goes, based on the will of Republican primary voters in the last primary election. So I and all delegates will be voting for Donald Trump in that first round of elections.
If there's a second ballot, who do you vote for?
If we're unbound, at that point, I've not made any determination about my intentions. I'm going to Cleveland with an open mind.
Well, County Executive Steve Hsu, I appreciate your time and safe trip to Cleveland. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Anne Arundel County Executive Steve Hsu, during the next couple of weeks, we'll be concentrating on the Republican and Democratic conventions, speaking of those. And on August 3rd, we will resume our Focus on the County series when we talk to Harford County Executive Barry Glassman. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, Baltimore author James Magruder tells us about his new novel set at Yale University during the Reagan era in the 1980s. But first, it's Wednesday. That's the day that we bring you the environment in focus.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My next guest is the Baltimore-based author James Magruder. Not Magruber, Magruder. His new novel follows the trials and tribulations of a group of graduate students at Yale University in the 1980s. It's called Love Slaves of Helen Hadley Hall. James Magruder is the former dramaturg at Center Stage. He's an award-winning translator, a playwright, and the author of two other novels, and he joins me in the studio. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Tom.
So I had a theme song that was almost your actual name. I came close. Magruber as opposed to Magruder.
Yeah, so, very close.
You know.
It's just one consonant away.
If you're getting mistaken for somebody, might as well get mistaken for Magruber because he was a genius, you know? This book is a hoot. It's a kick. It's a fun read. Although I will tell you, when you see the title Love Slaves of Helen Hadley Hall, the last thing I probably would guess it's about is a bunch of graduate students at a prestigious university like Yale. I mean, tell us about Helen Hadley and the hall that is named after her.
Helen Hadley Hall is a dorm. A graduate dorm was founded in 1958 as a place for female graduate students to study because at the time Yale College was in co-ed. So when Yale College went co-ed in 1968, they opened it to men as well. And as over time, more and more international students came. In the 80s, when I went there, it had two nicknames. One was Smellin' Badly Hall. Because there were all sorts of international odors and flavors. And then there's the F word palace. You would say it's the palace because of all of the activity. I mean, AIDS had been identified as a killer for a couple of years, but nobody knew yet how it was caused. So this was very licentious times, innocent, carefree.
Yeah. But early in the book, one of the characters refers to AIDS, which was still a sort of mysterious thing, as the gay cancer.
Right.
But it was actually during that particular year, 83, 84, that they identified a virus as the cause of it. But as you say, the way it was transmitted was still very much up in the air.
Yeah, there was the, you worried about the three H's, which is Haitian, homosexual, or hemophiliac. In April of 84, the government discovered it was a virus, and they predicted a cure within 2 years. And we know that didn't happen.
Didn't quite happen, although they're certainly a lot further along that
Absolutely.
Path than they were in 83, 84. And in that very school year, you were, in fact, a graduate student at Yale.
I did. I started the French department, and I did three semesters there and then defected to the drama school. And in a way, I've combined my 6 or 7 years of schooling at Yale into this these two magical semesters.
And the particular time that you chose, I mean, you could have set this before then, after that, why were you attracted to that period?
I think this was my first year. The people that I met at that dorm, I just loved, or I loved how foolish we all were. And I wanted to commemorate that time. It was before I discovered that I had the HIV virus. So I wanted to, again, celebrate this last moment of you could say, unsafety.
Yeah. And of course, graduate school is a very particular moment in time for people who end up in either academia or other professions. I mean, it's undergraduate school, for example, for a lot of folks can be a kind of a frivolous experimental time. Graduate school, you're supposed to start getting serious about what you're going to be when you grow up. And so it's an interesting backdrop for these many, many relationships that happen in this book.
Yes. I mean, you're supposed to get serious, but you're still 22 or 23 if you don't take any time off. And so while you get to be in this great educational institution, you're still the lowest person on the totem pole. You're trying to find mentors. You're trying to focus. And then, of course, your lower chakras can take over and suddenly you're in love. And that is just as important as, you know, DeMond's theory of the missing hero,
right,
or something like that. Or it's like
deconstructing literature one way or the
absolutely.
Other. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about a few of the people who are residents of Helen Hadley Hall. And we should also say that the narrator is Helen Hadley herself, but she narrates from beyond the grave.
Yes. Helen Hadley, I call her, she's an ectoplasmic emanation, and she watches over everybody. There's a portrait of her in the lobby of the dorm.
And she was a real person.
She was a real person.
That real portrait is still there.
It's still there. And she picks her favorites every year. And I think this year of 83, 84, it's her favorite year. She has five chief love slaves, two men and three women. And one is Nixie Bolger, who's come back from France, and she's the queen bee. And she falls in love instantly with a stage manager at the drama school. And she's a pre-Freudian character, so she doesn't understand why. But she just barrels ahead with an amazing lack of self-consciousness that afflicts everyone else. There's Becky Engelking, who's a soprano, a dramatic soprano, which means she's even more special in her own mind, from Iowa. And she's come to sort of wipe the traces of the family farm off of her shoes. She wants to become the diva and acquire temperament. And she falls in love with Brent Fladmo, who, of course, because all male organists are always, always, always gay. She doesn't know that right away. So they all encounter their own self-delusion and follies, and they recombine. And it's, as one of my blurbers said, it's like a telenovela. Just an Ivy League telenovela.
And there are types in here, and there are types that I even recognize from my years in graduate school, which were a few years before 83, 84. And as you say, you know, almost every organist I know is gay. I know very few straight choral conductors, actually. It's interesting. In my musical life, I'm used to the mm-hmm. types of Becky Engelking. I mean, I know 1,000 people like her. But these are actually based on individuals. These are not composite characters.
No. With the two exceptions of the, let's say, 30 characters, everyone is somebody that was in that dorm or was in a classroom with me or was one of my professors or was somebody I was romantically involved with. It's really, again, a celebration of that innocent, idiotic time. It's a dorm of fools is the way you could describe this book.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
Yeah, it's very fun. And the intermingling and the cohabitations and the relationships that start and stop and sputter and, you know, get revived. I mean, that really was my experience in graduate school, too. That was, and as you say, the love lives of everybody was just as important, if not more important, than everything we were studying. You're still teaching undergraduates now. Do you think graduate school and undergraduates, for that matter, are much different now 30 years hence?
I think they're having a lot less sex in the flesh. There might be more virtual stuff. But in the 80s, the drama school, Kathy Zuber, the famous costume designer, said it was love piles. It's not that way anymore. And, you know, I teach at Swarthmore, which is so progressive. I don't think they're, I always tell them on Valentine's Day when we do sex comedy, I say, now everyone go out and get laid. And they look at me like,
as an assignment.
Well, right? As an assignment. And I say, I'm an adjunct. You can't get me fired for that.
Well, the book is a lot of fun. I appreciate your coming in and talking about it. James Magruder, his new novel is called Love Slaves of Helen Hadley Hall. He'll be talking about the book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Atomic Books in Hamden. He'll also be at the Pratt Library on Cathedral Street in Baltimore next month. That event is on Tuesday, August 16th at 6:30, and it will include Baltimore author Jen Mikulski and the Washington, D.C.-based author Amber Sparks. More information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, another edition of Health Watch with Baltimore Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen, sports with Mark Hyman, and a visit with hip-hop legend Wyclef Jean in advance of his appearance at Artscape this weekend. Hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.